Breezeway is all about uncovering initiatives that are forever changing the guest experience. Breezeway's best-in-class property operations and messaging platform helps do just that by helping operators differentiate their brand and deliver more service to their clients. Breezeway's smart messaging tools makes it easy to send welcome messages, resolve in-house issues, share status updates, and offer stay extensions and other services. Powering operations with messaging also enables automated texts to notify guests when a property is ready for check-in, along with assigning work orders to your staff the second guests message in with a request. Combine the power of your operations with client communications and visit breezeway.io/guestx to learn more. That's breezeway.io/guestx to learn more.
Welcome to the GuestX podcast, where my co-host Brian Hamowy and I uncover the latest technologies and human-driven initiatives that are raising customer expectations and forever changing how we define customer experience across a host of industries. If you're passionate about creating incredible content and unique experiences, join us as we talk to leading product and experience experts across the globe and learn about how today's most successful brands are setting themselves apart from the competition. Good morning, Mr. Hamowy. How are you, bud?
I'm excited. It's not a Sunday night recording in our office at 9 or 10 o'clock. So this is back to regular schedule, I think, for us.
Back to regular schedule. I'm still married, which is nice after the last Sunday night. No. Well, I didn't say I didn't sleep on the couch. I just said I'm still married. I was telling you earlier, got to be the most excited I've been for one of our podcast today. And you've got a close connection with our guest, you and your brother, who's been nice enough to join us earlier last year. But love for you to tell our guests a little bit about what we've got in store, because it is really special today.
Yeah, I'm super excited about today's episode. So today we're joined by New York Times bestselling author Chip Connelly. He's been awarded as most innovative CEO by the San Francisco Business Times. Chip is the recipient of hospitality's highest honor, the Pioneer Award. He holds a BA and MBA from Stanford University. Not only that, but at 26, he founded Joie de Vivre Hospitality, which he ran for 24 years before joining Airbnb as the head of global hospitality and strategy to help them transform their business. Today, Chip is the founder of the Modern Eld Academy. I mean, if there is a resume that you want to read out and look up, it's Chip's. Chip, welcome to the show. I'm really excited to have you. I know Matt is as well. So it's an honor to have you on.
Oh, it's an honor to be here. Coming to you from Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Santa Fe, New Mexico. So Beautiful. What's the weather like over there? I'm in Florida. I know Matt is as well.
Oy vey. Oy vey. It's, it's cold. It's you know, it's mid-March here, and I would expect it to be a little warmer, but we had some snow the last 2 days.
Wow.
But snow in New Mexico lasts a very short time because it's a sunny, dry place. So yes, you get the best of both worlds, but yeah, it is a little cold right now.
We'll dive into why you're in New Mexico a little bit later, because I think it's a really fun expansion to what you guys are doing in Mexico. But, you know, for our listeners, I think what would be interesting is let's start at the top. I want our listeners to get to know you a little bit better. If they've never heard about Chip Connelly, tell us your story. How did you get started in hospitality in our industry and get to do so many great things for our industry?
So I didn't know I'd go into hospitality, but when I was a kid, you know, we were sort of a classic middle-class American family. We had the station wagon with the wood panels on the side, and we would, you know, we'd have our AAA guidebook as we drove around the American West. And each time we'd stay in a motel, I would rate the motel. Like, well, yeah, here's what it needed to do better. So it's funny. Who knew that all these years later, I would end up starting a boutique hotel company. When I graduated from Stanford Business School, I went into commercial real estate development in San Francisco, and it wasn't creative enough for me. So 2.5 years after I joined a firm, I decided to start a hotel company at age 26, which is sort of crazy, because boutique hotels were as a sort of a type of hotels were just getting off the ground in the United States. And so Ian Schrager and Bill Kempton had created their brands just 2 or 3 years before me. And yeah, so I bought a motel in the Tenderloin of San Francisco that was a pay by the hour. It was a no-tell motel, you know, the kind of place where you go on your lunch hour doing illicit things. And that became the Phoenix, a rock and roll hotel. And then over the course of the next 24 years, we created 52 boutique hotels, all of them in California, and became the second largest boutique hotel company in the U.S. I loved it. Every single one of the hotels had its own name, its own identity, its own sub-market, a niche of people it was going after. Each time we created a hotel, it was based upon a magazine and five adjectives. So the personality of the hotel was based upon like Rolling Stone magazine for the first one. Long story short is it was all a beautiful opportunity for me to learn about people. And I think that's my number one lesson from my time as a boutique hotelier was psychology is probably the most important thing to understand when it comes to creating product hospitality products, but also servicing your guests.
It is incredible and almost a dream for most people that are in hospitality. I know when, and I run a property, small, you know, boutique property management company here, but it's all about building that experience. And I think it comes from the creativity that goes into the units so that you can deliver just something that is out of the box, outstanding. And if you have the ability to do that for the guests to enjoy, it takes it to a completely different level.
Yes.
I was thinking from a lot of our listeners' standpoint, just the idea of starting from scratch to just from concept all the way through to launch. How did you even start to think about, were you thinking about guest experience and here's how I want my guests to feel when they walk in and here's the, or did it happen more organically as you look back now?
It definitely happened organically.
Yeah.
Thank God I didn't have 52 hotels all at once because you know, you build your wisdom based upon your mistakes along the way. I would just say that I think there are two sort of, you know, V8 moments, so to speak. You know, I kind of had a V8. What I mean by that is like an epiphany that really helped me to understand guest experience. And beyond just all the stories I could tell you about individual guests. One was this idea of creating hotels based upon magazines. Magazines are lifestyle oriented and niche oriented. And therefore, given that that's the case, so are boutique hotels. So, so let me use an example. One of our hotels in San Francisco was called the Hotel Vitali. And it was based upon two magazines, Real Simple, sort of a women's lifestyle magazine, and Dwell. And the sort of urban design, you know, modern design magazine. And so the combination of those two magazines led to five adjectives. And the five adjectives were modern, urbane, fresh, natural, and nurturing. And everything we did in creating that hotel had to come back to those five adjectives. And similarly, what we learned is that the people who fell in love with the hotel would use those five adjectives to describe themselves. So that was sort of like an epiphany, like, wow, what if a hotel, what if you are where you sleep, not you are what you eat, you are where you sleep, such that the hotel creates an identity refreshment. It creates this mirror for your aspirations. Okay, that was one key lesson. And I learned that over time. The second key lesson happened, you know, in the early, you know, part of this, like 20 years ago, in the early part of the century, we're going through the dot-com bust, 9/11, SARS, et cetera. And, you know, the hotel business in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is where most of our hotels were, was really in trouble. And that's when I used some psychology. So that's when I used Maslow's hierarchy of needs to sort of say, okay, well, if there's a hierarchy of needs for humans, and just to recap for those who don't remember it, there's physiological needs at the base, safety needs, second level, third level, social belonging needs, fourth level, esteem, and fifth level, self-actualization. Well, if there's five levels, if you were to summarize those five levels into three key themes, it's survival at the base of the pyramid, success in the middle, and at the top is transformation. So we applied that transformation pyramid, survival, success, transform, to our three most important stakeholders, our employees, our customers, and our investors. The customer pyramid looks like this. Expectations are at the base, desires are in the middle, and unrecognized needs are at the top. So the way I started and the way we as a company started to look at our product was, you know, what are the expectations of our customers? And usually they were quite physical, you know, like clean bathroom, you know, comfortable bed, you know, feels safe in the parking lot or wherever. It was pretty simple stuff. And of course, the higher end the product, the higher the expectations. And then what are the desires? But it was the unrecognized needs. If you can actually address the unrecognized needs of a customer, you have unlocked evangelism from your customer base like you've never seen before. And that's really what we did. And I ended up writing a book about this called Peak, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow. And that book really, I think, helped a lot of companies, including Barry Stern, like back in the day of creating W, something, a business you know very well, Matt. You know, he was using some of the Maslowian thoughts I had around how does W as a brand address unrecognized needs of customers. So this was after the launch of W. This was like 2005 or so, when he and I were talking a lot. But I was, you know, very close to him when he was starting W, and I know how obsessive he was. I'll never forget it when he launched W San Francisco, and I was there at the opening party, and I was walking around with him, and he didn't like the music that was being played. And so he literally went over to the DJ and said, "Here's what you're going to play." he was that much of a stickler for details. So, you know, he's been a very successful entrepreneur, but not always easy to work with.
Sure.
No, and I imagine that's probably true for most successful people.
Myself included. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, if you care about your brand, which I'd love to jump into, but if you care about your brand, you're going to look at everything and everyone that's around you and just be very careful on, you know, the way everybody does everything. And so, you know, let's talk about brand a little bit, because I think we talk about brand very broadly in our industry, but as, you know, hospitality dives into branding, what are the essential things that people should be looking at when they start to develop their brand? It's a huge topic. It's a very difficult topic, but there are some essential things that people, when they're starting to create, first, maybe identifying what a brand is, and then how do you start to execute that? Because in my mind, you need a lot of resources and you need people to be able to do that. That's not a single man's job. And for a lot of our listeners, we're smaller companies, but if we want to build a true brand and grow it, what are some of the key things that we should be paying attention to, and how do we go to market with that?
So let's start by saying a brand is a differentiated promise. So as a promise has been said a lot, I think it's really a differentiated promise, because actually if your brand is purely a commodity promise, like every other brand, you're sort of at the base of that pyramid. You're just delivering on expectations, and loyalty is not created at the base of the pyramid. It's created higher up the pyramid. So a differentiated promise. The promise piece means that, you know, people, you're building an expectation. And the differentiation says, here's our USP, or here's our unique sales proposition. There's an element of, what I'd start with is like, okay, so why should anybody care that you're in business? In fact, that's the question I often ask people, is like if you went out of business tomorrow, who would be disappointed and why? And if the answer is no one, something went wrong. So the differentiated promise is the thing that you're offering to the marketplace and to your customers that may not be offered by anybody else. Then you have to get into the question of like, how do you execute on that? And frankly, well, actually, no. Next is, do people understand that promise? And that's actually, we're going to talk in a few minutes about the Modern Elder Academy, which is my newest business. And we'll talk about Airbnb, because both of them had... I actually think it was easier with Joie de Vivre as a boutique hotel company for people to understand our promise. Although Joie de Vivre was complicated because we had 52 hotels, each one with its own promise, 52 different brands. So that was complicated. Airbnb had a promise, which is home sharing. But that's not really a promise. And it's not a differentiated promise. Well, it sort of is, but you know, if home sharing is like, okay, well, I could go stay in someone else's home who's a friend. Why would I pay them? So when I joined Airbnb, gosh, more than 9 years ago, to basically be the head of global hospitality and strategy, but also to be the mentor to Brian, the CEO and co-founder, one of the first exercises we did was like, we asked the question, what business are we in? You know, and we did, it's an exercise you can, you know, where you ask the question five times. So I asked Brian with our top 12 executives, so Brian, what business are we in? And he said, we're in the home sharing business. And I said, thank you, Brian. And I asked him again, what business are we in? And he cannot answer the same way twice. So by the time you get to the fifth answer, like, you've really maybe done a little archaeological dig about what the essence of your business is. And what we came to is that we're in the belong anywhere business. Now, belong anywhere is very different than being in the home sharing business. Home sharing is a category. Belong anywhere is a feeling. And so then we needed to figure out how to do our customers understand what belong anywhere means? And then do our hosts, which I was in charge of around the world, how do they understand how to deliver on belong anywhere? And then how do we operationalize and market around that? So it's, yeah, you can come up with a great brand, but if it's not understood by your customer, so the Modern Elder Academy, which we'll talk about, is a midlife wisdom school. What the hell is a midlife wisdom school? That's a little bit hard for some people to understand. But we're in the business of helping people reframe aging. Oh, well, I don't want to think about aging. So if you're reframing something I don't want to think about, how do you deal with that? So we're still in process, I would say, on MEA. You know, we'll talk about it. But I would say anybody who thinks that they're going to get it right immediately with their brand doesn't realize that your customer is going to teach you over time whether you've gotten it right, both in terms of they understand it, and then number two, can you deliver on that? So that's branding 101.
That's a lot to unpack right there.
I think I've written it down like four times, the differentiated promise, because it is something people need to understand why I should get invested into this brand. So I think that's the promise. Like, if here's what you're going to get out of it, there's a reason for you to spend the limited time you have in life with our brand. But then it also has to, there has to be a limited place for me to get that promise. Or it's not differentiated from a bunch of different places. And to your point, Chip, I think it becomes a commodity. You know, one of the things I struggle with, and I'd love your thoughts on brand, is as you think about brand, and even back to your initial hotels, but then also Airbnb, do you create the brand and not worry about the scalability and know that a great brand will find, you know, will find ways to be scalable? Or do you have to think, because you mentioned 52 hotels, all different, I'm sure some big people came to you at some point and said, look, you can't build a boutique hotel brand that's all different in every location. Or do you not really think about that? And it'll
work out. Competitors did something different than we did. So Kimpton created Monaco as a sub brand, Palomar as a sub brand, Schrager created Delano, Mondrian as sub brands, but we just never did it. And yeah, should we have? We probably should have. Yeah, what we really wanted to do was have each one be a piece of like an original piece of art, and you know, you don't replicate a piece of art. So, you know, in terms of your question about scalability, it's something that Brian used to say all the time, Brian Chesky, who was my boss at 21 years younger than him, and I was his mentor. So how weird is that? You know, you're mentoring your boss, but he says, let's do things that are not scalable. And when I first heard him say that, I was like, well, that's sort of stupid, because we want to be a global company. But his point was this, and it's very much sort of lingo of Silicon Valley. Do things that are not scalable initially in a way such that your handprints, your fingerprints are all over it and you're understanding it. So it's really not a proper statement, because it's more like do things initially where you're creating evangelists. Better to have 100 evangelists than 10,000 people who like the product but don't care so much about it. And so what he was saying is be in bed, so to speak, with your customers, your initial customers, and then you can understand how to scale it. Because if you can't scale it, yeah, you could create a product. I mean, there's lots of bespoke products out there that have a high-end price point, partly because it costs a lot to produce it. Mm-hmm. And then it's really hard to scale it. And that's fine. Maybe they can be a niche product long-term as a luxury good. That's fine. But, you know, Airbnb was not meant to be that. That's for sure. And then the flip side of that is if you exclusively focus on scalability on the front end, you actually lose the soul. So we talk about scale versus soul. We used to talk about this at Airbnb. We talk about it at MBA now. Scale versus soul. It is the fascinating juxtaposition or paradox of how do you start with soul and then how do you scale the soul? And if you do it right, you can be a very successful large business. But there's a lot of companies that have not done it right. They got the soul right, fingerprints all over it, and then the scaling process actually lost the soul. So I think that, so what I would say to be practical here is, what is the soul of your business? What is it that makes it different? And if you have something that you feel is making it different that is not scalable, let's say, for example, in the context of the Modern Elder Academy, which I keep saying we'll talk about soon, but I keep bringing it up. So there are three of us who are the co-founders, me and Jeff, Brian's brother, and Christine Sperber. And if we said Chip and Jeff and Christine have to actually be involved in every workshop that we do, that would not be scalable. Mm-hmm. So that's a good example of, okay, we've got to figure out the scalability piece and build a team of facilitators who can learn from us and then take it forward. So I think that's an important question to be asked, you know, in the early stages of a business.
I think what's fascinating for me, especially with the Airbnb model, is that they built a brand. And underneath that brand, they've given us the ability to build sub-brands. Mm-hmm. And each one of these brands has a soul for the most part, which has also enabled us to be able to scale. Is that something that ever came up in conversation when you were at the company? Because it's remarkable how successful some people, and I've had some examples doing some talks where property managers build their business solely on Airbnb as the brand, but they built a sub-brand underneath. And I can't really think of another example that has done it so well. That has the ability to show our soul as a business on a platform, sell ourselves, and build a brand based on a brand.
Yeah, it there's what's the craft, the website with crafts based in Brooklyn?
Etsy,
a little bit of that, eBay, a little bit of that, but Airbnb probably more so. Basically, they're all marketplaces. So it's you're creating a marketplace and a two-sided marketplace and with a buyer and a seller. And I think where Airbnb had a challenge in this, and this is again scale versus soul. And I was pretty much the lead person in the company trying to solve this along with the founders, which is Airbnb loved the narrative of, you know, there's a person has just their cottage in the backyard or the room down the hallway or maybe a cabin in the mountains, and they have one listing and you're the host of one listing. And of course, Airbnb became so successful that it attracted a lot of people who saw it as a beautiful way to create a business around it. And Airbnb, in the time I was there, and I was there for over seven years, 4 years full-time, 3 years as a pretty active strategic advisor. It was hard because the founders were like, no, we just have these single hosts. And I was like, well, guess what? We have a lot of professional hosts too. And where that became an issue is in cities like New York, San Francisco, et cetera, where there are housing crises. And how do we address that and have, address regulation so that, you know, you don't screw up the rental market. But then there's places like Lake Tahoe or, all over Florida and other places where they're vacation rental areas. And like, there have been property managers there and there've been second homes there that are rented out. And so how do we tap into that? We were slow as a company to go that direction, partly because of a reticence or caution about us becoming too identified with the professionals. You know, at this point, we don't worry about that anymore. We allow regulations in cities to define whether, you know, we should have multiple property owners with their own sub-brand or not. But I will tell you, back in the days when I was saying, that's the direction we're going to go, guys, because it's a huge market. we shouldn't just be focusing on urban markets. Thank God we did. Back in the early days, you know, more than 50% of our revenues were coming from 20 cities in the US. I'm sorry, 20 cities in the world. And it's like, wow, you know, during the pandemic, that would have been really tough. And thank God we expanded beyond. And Airbnb is an amazing testament to resilience and adaptability, you know, from the pandemic, you know, to see the value of the company go over $100 billion during the pandemic, when in a time where the hotel companies were really, really having challenges. So I would say, yes, the idea of the sub brands and how we did it, it wasn't elegant. It wasn't like part of the original plan. It was something we had to evolve into based upon what we were seeing from the market.
I remember the first time I heard about Airbnb, we were all put in a conference room here in Orlando by our software company. And they said, you guys need to come and listen to this pitch. It's another OTA. And I went with Rebecca, with my wife. And everybody in the audience was like, this is just not going to work. They're so focused on the individual homeowner. There's no way that professionals. And about a year and a half later, we walked out and we're like, how the hell do you survive without Airbnb? Everybody's talking Airbnb. And till this day, you know, we restarted. And honestly, I think I don't know what I would do without Airbnb. And I don't know that homeowners would either.
Well, many times. So it is a testament to the brand, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, this is a good example of where you create a product where you really focus on the customer. Sort of like Amazon. Amazon's very customer centric. Airbnb is pretty customer centric. Sometimes hosts hate that because of the fact that there's an element of like, oh, you like the guests more than the host. You know, we try to create a balance there. But the bottom line is people are not, they're not loyal to booking.com. They're not loyal to Expedia. They're not loyal to most of the products that are out there in the OTA space. But guests, and to some degree, hosts, are very loyal to Airbnb without a loyalty program. We do not have Airbnb does not have, you know, a loyalty or a recognition program. I mean, like, it is incredible. And Nate, one of the co-founders, says, well, our loyalty program is just our product. And he's sort of right. He's sort of right. But I do believe that one of the things that Airbnb should do and has been talking about doing for 5 years now is to create a recognition program. Probably not something that provides a lot of financial benefit, but something that allows you to know, God, I'm a regular on the platform and I should be treated like a VIP in certain ways. We do have, you know, Airbnb supposedly, I'm now, 2.5 years from being actively involved in the company, so I can't tell you. But, you know, for the hosts, there's, you know, if you're a big host, you're supposed to have some additional services provided you. Less so for the guests. And that's an unfortunate thing that should be solved.
I think one of the successes in my mind is that you guys built a community around everything, a community around the managers, the single hosts, and also an ecosystem for the guests to feel like they're a part of something, which leads me into, finally, the Modern Elder Academy. So tell our listeners a little bit about Modern, what you guys are doing, how you came up with this idea, because Jeff, you know, my brother, for those of you guys got a taste of Jeff, a little bit crazy, packed up his family, came to Colorado for 3 days and then said, I'm going to Mexico for the next 3 months, and literally packed this minivan and gets down to Mexico and then says, well, I got down to Mexico. I found Modern Elder Academy and I think I'm going to go and do something with them. And I said, what the heck are you up to now? So for our listeners, what is Modern and what are you up to?
Yeah, it's Modern Elder Academy, also known as MEA. sprouted out of my weird brain because when I was at Airbnb, they started calling me the Modern Elder because I was twice the age of the average employee there. I'm 61 now. I was 52 when I joined Airbnb, and the average age was 26. And they called me the Modern Elder because they said a Modern Elder is as curious as they are wise. And I was like, okay, well, if that's what a Modern Elder is, I don't like being called an elder. It sounds like elderly to me, but a Modern Elder is as curious as they are wise. That describes me pretty well. I don't know about the wisdom piece, but I know I'm curious. And so ultimately I went on to write a book called Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder. While I was writing that book in Baja, where I had a home just off the beach, I came to the conclusion after I took a run on the beach and I had a Baja aha, I had an epiphany. Why is it that we don't have midlife wisdom schools? Why don't we have a place where people can go? Our average age of people who come to MEA is 54. But it's the range is as young as 30 and as old as 88. Why don't we have a place where people can come and reimagine and repurpose what's next for them, both in their career, their personal life, maybe their health, maybe their spiritual life, and create a program that allows people to recognize that if you're at age 54, which is our average age, and you're going to live till 90, you're only halfway through your adult life if you start counting at age 18. So people have a lot more life ahead of them than they think. And yet there's not really a place to go to learn about, you know, how do you use that additional life? So we call it long life learning. And it's about how to create a life that's as deep and meaningful as it is long. It's workshops, but it's also MEA online programs. And now based upon Jeff, your brother's really beautiful vision, regenerative communities where people can actually live in community around a regenerative farm or ranch. And so we're really disrupting two industries. We're disrupting retirement communities with the regenerative communities. And in some ways, we're disrupting higher education as an industry, which is predominantly just focused on people 25 and younger. And it's like, well, what if people could take a gap year or a gap 6 months or even just a week to focus on themselves with a strong curriculum that helps them to repurpose themselves. So we have over 2,000 alumni now from 33 countries, and it's a thing. And it's part of the reason I'm in Santa Fe is because we're expanding from our Baja California Sur campus, which we will continue to have in Mexico. And that's where our first regenerative community is. And Santa Fe, New Mexico, we have three properties here, two that'll be academies and one that will be a regenerative community. So yes, it's a thing. And I like being a disruptor again. I was sort of a disruptor as a boutique hotelier. I was definitely a disruptor as an Airbnb leader. And I think I'm a disruptor again, even though I don't think anybody should call themselves a disruptor. Somebody else calls you, but I've been called that a lot. So, and I do it with Jeff and Christine and our team because it couldn't do it without them.
One of the ties I feel like to everything you've done is this concept. You've mentioned it a couple of times, but concept of community. Mm. And when Brian's brother was on with us, we talked about how you build a community, commerce will follow. Mm. And it's interesting as I think about some of the really successful brands, even over the last 5 or 10 years, certainly Airbnb probably at the top, but Peloton is another one that I think is more about community than it is about the product of their bikes and their treadmills and their content and their classes. They've created this just unbelievable community. Mm. What do you think it is? Do you feel like community is more important now for people with social media and just everything coming at us than it ever has been before? And that boosts those brands? Is that community?
Yes. The answer is yes. Why is community more important? You know, a few years ago when I was studying festivals and created a website called Fest 300, that lasted a little while, lasted a few years, no longer exists. I wanted to understand why in a world where the more digital we get, the more ritual in person we need. So there's the URL of websites, and then there's the IRL in real life. And I was a founding board member of Burning Man, the Burning Man Project, the huge festival in the Nevada desert. And I just sort of had a real curiosity. And I think there's a few things at play here. Number one is, yes, as we become more attached to the form of communication that is often online, what we know in our gut, we're missing something. So community can happen online. It can happen in person. So there's two kinds of community, and some of the best ones are hybrid. They're a combination of both. But communities that are purely online, it's hard for it to ever get to the traction of what a community having offline experiences can get to. I think that COVID accelerated all of this because we were in our own little bubbles at home, and there's a desperate need for community. I also think what it's led to is accelerated the desire for intentional community. So meditation and yoga were very much a hippie thing of the 1960s and 70s that went mainstream. Communes or kibbutzes were a thing of the you know, of the hippie generation of the 60s and 70s. And intentional communities didn't really ever go beyond that. And now they are. Mm. There are people saying, I want to live in a, and I'm not talking about just like, I want to live in a golf community. It's like, no, well, that's, right. That's not exactly an intentional community, because it's just like, it's a community that's based upon golf. That's fine. But a community based upon an ethos, a sort of a common point of view, and maybe some responsibility attached to that. That's a whole new idea. And it's an idea that's time has come, because it just like yoga and meditation went mainstream, I think intentional communities are about to do that as well. So I think communities on many level are going to be more essential. I think, frankly, when it comes to where people live after age 50, the idea of being in a community where you know all your neighbors and you do potlucks with them, and you don't have to worry about, like, you know, I have to live in an assisted living facility in my 70s. No, you don't. I mean, you're probably going to be fine. But my caregiving when I'm sick, or, you know, when I want some help, is my neighbor. Mm-hmm. I mean, back in the old days, it was your family, because you had intergenerational living. Well, today it might be your neighbors, because your neighbors are some of your closest friends. And so, you know, 95% of the caregiving that's needed for people, you know, in their later life is not acute care. It's not like medical. It's really more functional. And a lot of it, frankly, is communal, the societal, it's the social elements that people often are missing.
Yeah, it's a really interesting topic. I mean, we've got one of the largest, I think the largest retirement community here,
the villages.
What they've done there is so incredible. I mean, they've got, I think it's 250,000 homes up there now. But the facilities are fascinating, because you think about retirement and it's not necessarily, you know, you're going to this place and that's the end of it. These people are thriving. They're going to school, they're doing sports, the hospitals are incredible. So it's a place that they're actually going to enjoy their lives. And people are scared of getting older. Yeah. I'm one of those guys. I don't like the thought of getting old. But looking at some of the things that you guys are doing, I think, and the longer we live, the harder we have to think about what's the future of our life, because it isn't just over because you're getting older. You have to enjoy it. So as we start to wrap up, I'd love 3 pieces of advice from you. We ask this from every guest to our listeners. And we also ask for your most recent favorite book that you've read that our listeners should be reading.
Okay.
I'm putting you on the spot there.
Yeah, no, 3 pieces of advice. Well, you know, create a product that you're going to fall in love with yourself, but don't fall in too much in love with it. Meaning, don't create products that are not differentiated, not doing something that matters in the world, but don't fall so in love with it that you lack any objectivity around it. So that'd be a first one. A second piece of advice would be, do your best. And I challenge myself on this. Do your best to spread the wealth within the organization in terms of how you're getting great ideas from every part of your organization, great ideas from your customers as well. So don't feel like there's some group. And similarly, I think the third idea would be, culture doesn't belong to the HR department. Culture is something that everybody has to live, and there needs to be some core values that define the company that are the reason that people not only were attracted, but that as an employee, but that they stay. And frankly, your customers will appreciate core values as well. As for a book, I just finished reading Arthur Brooks' new book. So Arthur Brooks, well-known, he was a sort of a Politico kind of guy, but he is a faculty member at Harvard now, and wrote a book called From Strength to Strength. And it's really the story of how, it's pretty much the modern Elder Academy story of what is it you get better at with age? And how do you look at your life after age 50 in a way that feels like your best years are ahead of you as opposed to behind you? So it recently, 2 weeks ago, hit the New York Times bestsellers list as the number one book in the US. So it's getting attention. And actually, he does feature Modern Elder Academy in the latter part of the book.
Well, Chip, thank you so much. It's just, if we had borrowed another hour of your time, I think we could just keep going. But really appreciate, not only as people that are still actively trying to build businesses within hospitality, the work you've done, I don't think can be understated about not only the changes it's made to the industry, but the trails that have been blazed so that others can come behind you and build upon what you've built. It's from all of our listeners, and I know Brian and I, thank you very much for everything you've done and for the time today. It's been enlightening.
Yeah. Well, I hope people enjoy it, and feel free to go to the Modern Elder Academy website to learn more about us.
How do they reach it? What's the domain? How
yes.
do they
reach it? It's just modernelderacademy.com, and my personal one's chipconley.com. And we also have a daily blog called Wisdom Well. And you can find that on the Modern Elder Academy website, or just Google Chip Conley and Wisdom Well. And it's a daily blog that's free that just gets sent directly to your email each day. And I tend to post a lot of my daily blogs on LinkedIn as well, on my personal LinkedIn site.
A lot. I follow them.
All right.
Give Thanks, guys. Follow. Thank you, Chip.
All right. Chip.
That's it for this week's episode of GuestX. Be sure to sign up for our email list at guestxpodcast.com. That's guest, the letter X, podcast.com. And follow us on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss our next episode. We are Mr. Guest Experience, Brian Hamowy, and Matthew Loney signing off and reminding you to always create a customer experience worth talking about.